Hello, and welcome to The Squeal, PIC Swine Management Podcast, featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Pig behaviors, for those which aren't positive, what's the cause? As one of our guests said, it's multifactorial. Our expert panel includes animal behaviorist Dr. Simon Turner.
I'm Simon Turner. I'm a senior researcher in animal behavior at Scotland's Rural College.
With PIC specialist Dr. Isaac Huerta.
I'm Isaac Huerta. I'm the technical services manager for Western and Southern Europe and Africa.
Dr. Justin Hull.
My name is Justin Hull. I'm a geneticist within PIC.
I'm Nat Stass. I'm a technical service manager within PIC and predominantly on the wean to finish side.
And Nat Stass for part two of our three-episode pig behavior series on the squeal. So in the barn, we're seeing these behaviors that are suboptimal. What are causes? What's behind it?
Well, I think we can create a heck of a list, you know, and I think we're all going to focus on different things. But, you know, I tend to focus on a lot of management aspects. And so, I mean, gosh, I don't know. There can limited resources, nutrients, health challenges. I mean, you can go down through a whole long list of things. But, you know, something is creating disharmony in that pig's life. And so, you know, things that we focus on would be space, and that includes feeder space, floor space, water availability, air quality could be one. I am not a nutritionist nor a veterinarian, but there's components on both sides of that as well. And I'll start the list there, and then others can add their input from that.
Yeah, I think that list differs for each of the behaviors we're talking about. Some of them it is relatively short, like aggression at mixing is caused by the mixing of unfamiliar animals. They have to establish dominance, but it's exacerbated by them having to establish it in a small space. So if we can give them more space, then they can sort it out easier and so on. Yep. And, you know, having to compete over resources like feeders will exacerbate long-term aggression. And in some cases, it can trigger tail biting as well. But for tail biting itself, that list of causative factors on the management side is, it's almost easier to think of things that aren't risk factors than things that are.
Yep.
That list is so long.
So the list can be endless. I mean, not mention the big picture of all of them. And he was talking about the water quality or air quality. I mean, it's not only sometimes the quality. I would say that I always put together in terms of feed, water, air, all these things, quality, quantity, and how access is for all the animals. No, so it you can vary, then you can make the picture as big as you want, and not it's the expert here on this area, but I like the point of, I mean, anything that will change the surrounding of the pig, and he doesn't feel good of that, it can be anything, any particular thing that we don't realize. Even that small thing of having an empty feeder for a few minutes during the day when they are willing to eat. That stressor that we try to say, come on, it's been only 5 minutes, or it's been only 30 minutes, or the courting can be the courting or the window down, and it enters air draft on top of the animal. He might not feel comfortable at that time. He doesn't have enough space to move, to protect himself, to change the situation that he's surrounded by. That's anything related, any stressor that will change the situation that he feels comfortable, it might lead to a that particular abnormal. And of course, as Simon said, it's different depending on the behavior that you are looking for. You might see some stressors that might be bigger list and some others that might be smaller list.
Yeah, and that kind of leads me into, you know, a thought or a comment about, you know, Simon has a nice depiction of a tipping cup, and we kind of have a graph with an intervention level, and, you know, how we raise animals in production settings. You know, oftentimes we do have some, just from a cost perspective, we're trying to bump right up to that line where there may be some challenges. We don't want to give them so much space that it becomes cost prohibitive to raise pigs and things like that. And so, you know, at any given time, you may not think there's a huge drastic change in that environment or in that facility or in that barn. But any given time, there could be one minor, minute change that tips it over. And it's not that necessarily individual silver bullet issue that we need to improve and fix. It's really the big picture. And so oftentimes it's multifactorial and there's multiple things that we want to make slight improvements in to basically get below that intervention level. And so that we don't have those challenges and more particularly when it comes to vices challenges. So they're your tail biting, your side lesions, your ear biting, et cetera.
So Matt, in all our experience, and I will include you here, you made a very good point. It's not many cases. I would not say anyone, because maybe one that can be dramatic, it might be one single thing that made that to happen. So as you really said, the word multifactorial, that we love that word because it's very easy to say by the technicians, right? It's multifactorial and it makes us look, I would say, a little bit stupid, if you allow me to say that word. And it's normal, it's the reality. It's not one single thing that will make that change. So it's almost always it's multifactorial things, so different things. It can be the quality of the air, the feet, the water, the density, all these things that we already mentioned, the list, but it's a combination of all of them. It's not normal, it's not only one of them. I mean, the pig, it's a good animal. He's able to suffer. So he knows how to suffer a little bit. So only one thing might not make him completely change the going out of mind, if you understand what I mean.
I think it's, whilst we accept these things are multifactorial and something as complex as tail biting is, some of those factors play a larger or lesser part in it. So we know that there are some factors that have a particularly important role, like enrichment material. You know, it's one of the things that we know from lots of research has a big impact on the occurrence of tail biting. But that aside, I think I agree with everything that's said, that we've got to get all of the details right alongside that. You know, it's not just looking at these kind of iceberg things that we need to provide. We need to get all of the detail around that right as well.
How do we manage so that we make sure that we haven't painted over the rust on the car, put enrichment material over the problem to try to solve it? Where do we start at? And Justin, maybe that's what you were getting ready to comment on.
Yeah, that was really a question that I'd have is it different for like an acute type of situation or a chronic situation in terms of seeing vices, if this is something that's reoccurring or if it's a, you know, something that really occurs very quickly, are the things that you look for different?
I guess the challenge with vices is predicting them. You know, that is why they are such a nightmare to manage because, you know, as we've all said, you can make a very small change and suddenly you have a problem. And predicting, identifying that change has happened and predicting what it's going to do is really challenging. So for vice behavior, generally we say that prevention is better than cure because quite often the cure involves quite a lot of effort and quite a lot of hassle. You know, preventing something like tail biting once it's started is quite a task. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if we can prevent these things and keep the animal below the point at which, you know, as Nat said, I tend to think of the animals being kind of a cup that's on the edge of tipping over. If we can keep it on the right side of tipping over, then it's an awful lot easier than dealing with it once it's already tipped over.
So why we don't see that differently? And I think that would be something that Ned would like. I mean, first of all, if it's difficult to predict and it's multifactorial, the way that we deal with it, myself and all the ones that we are here and all the colleagues that we have in the ground, I would say that first, as a veterinarian or any caretaker, any person related with the animals, the first thing that we need to do is to work on allowing the animals to behave naturally, to have all the needs for the pigs, all the ones that we know. And now might just enter to that conversation. And if we can create a nice, let's say, different points of view, no, but My job is to try to give all the needs that the pigs have to achieve the highest standards on welfare possible as possible in all the situations. But of course, the pig is changing, and I guess that then Justin can jump in, but the pig is changing. So it's making my work maybe not being completely perfect because I don't know the needs always. The needs of the animals are changing, are evolving with all that. So our job is to do the best to achieve the needs for the pigs and to have these high quality standards in place in all the situations. When we have that, I think that it's preventing side. It's trying to do as much as possible before that the problem happens.
Just to add to that, I mean, I think we have a lot of resources. We have a lot of recommendations, and I think that's where we start. You know, it's not something you can implement and just it's going to work forever either. I mean, we're constantly revising. You know, we're going to put out a wean to finish manual every 4 to 5-ish years, right? And we're going to update those recommendations, and we're going to work with the geneticist within our company to understand that. You know, we collect feeding behavior information, or at least to the highest ability we can today. We work with academic institutes. We work with groups like that Simon has to understand where these recommendations need to fall in. And so we have those resources available, and we're going to continually update them to not only what is the most cost-effective way to raise a PIC pig, but, you know, what is the most ideal way to do that to minimize these challenges, or these, whether it's aggressive behavior or vices challenges, et cetera. We're going to continually update those resources on all the topics that we've discussed thus far.
So when we go back to that enrichment material, is it possible to promote positive behavior with products such as that?
We'll likely provoke some degree of exploration and play and things like that. Quite what the benefits of positive behaviors are is actually quite an open question at the minute. You know, a lot of species will engage in positive social behavior, which suggests that in wild animals, it's been selected by evolution because it has a benefit. The truth is we don't really know what the biological benefits are, or indeed the production benefits of positive social behaviors, but the animals do them, and they're probably doing them for a good reason, but we just don't really know what they are yet. But yes, providing them with the kind of environment that helps to prevent tail biting will likely stimulate these positive social interactions as well.
Makes me think of the happy cows in California. Not really a definitive, but they were able to sell a lot of milk.
There's been things done over time that has tried to promote positive behavior. I mean, even when it comes down to like feeder designs and trying to feed in a group setting versus, you know, just feeding individually, those types of things. I mean, there's positives in that. So there are some things that we can do to help promote that. You know, I can think, for example, we have some sites where we do try to capture individual feed intake, and those pigs tend not to grow as quickly as those that are on, you know, a multi-hold feeder. I think that kind of goes back to the group dynamics. And I know there was some work out at the USDA that kind of showed the benefits of that group eating dynamic. And so there are some things that I think are there to help promote those things, and maybe it's things like enrichment, but some of that is also just in terms of some of the designs of facilities.
So going back to your point, Ned, you said like enrichment or toys, that might be a good thing to comment here. I mean, maybe that's one of the biggest mistakes that we do. I mean, we think that enrichment in terms of toys, it's the solution or the only solution. And as Nat mentioned before, it's one part and it's important, but you have the rest. And without the rest, the toy will not make the work that it's intended to do. So sometimes the mistake is like, oh, let's use a straw, let's use a piece of wood, let's use whatever kind of toy. And then you have the windows completely wrong, the temperature of the pen or the room. You have the density not correct. You have the feeder space not correct. I mean, you did a mistake on unloading the feed for that particular pen, that it was not supposed to be on that age or that weight. So sometimes it's true what you pointed. No, the people you go to a farm and they, yeah, I'm using toys. Yeah, and so what? I mean, toys is not the only solution. Of course, it's important. And we see that every day, that it's important to do a review on the kind of toys, the location of the toys, which kind. But it's not the only thing. I mean, let's not forget the animal needs to eat and needs to drink and needs to be healthy. It needs to be safe. He needs to feel like it's comfortable. So let's not play the game, or not allow our colleagues or our people that work with the animals to play the game of, hey, I have some behavioral problems. Let's add some toys and that's done. I did my job. No, that's not done. It's the beginning, let's say.
Yeah, and I appreciate having some Europeans on this discussion, because they're way well more versed in the enrichment than we are in North America here. But you know, you got to be careful with that as well, because it can become a limiting factor. You know, just by adding a single thing in a pen is a quote unquote enrichment material or product, it may become a limiting factor. And Simon's brought up multiple times about the exploratory behavior of pigs, and it could get old after a while too, and it may need changed. And so if we do use enrichment material, whatever that may be, we want to make sure it's not limiting. So therefore it creates fighting around that enrichment material. And then, you know, something with it is constantly changing and keeping those pigs engaged from an exploratory perspective as well.
If we're talking about positive behaviors, we're talking about more than the absence of negative behaviors. And I think that is an area that we are going to explore an awful lot more in coming years, and just try to, I suspect there's quite a rich seam of production gains to be had by having animals that actually are showing positive behaviors. The little work that we know, I mean, Ned, you mentioned before there, the happy cows, the little work that we've seen in pigs suggests those that do a lot of playing when they're young tend to grow fast. And where the cause and effect there is, we don't really know. But we see animals, pigs that do a lot of, you know, very gentle and positive kind of social nosing interaction, not tail biting, but just gentle social nosing, tend to grow faster as well. So, you know, actually we maybe shouldn't in the future think about these positive types of interactions as being a luxury, but it's actually being something that's a really good indicator that's going to encourage fast growth. And things like enrichment and, you know, a complex sort of interesting social environment as well is the kind of thing that we know in pigs and other species tends to promote positive social interactions. Or conversely, when we deny animals the opportunity to socialize when they're young or to have an enriched kind of physical environment, we know that greatly constrains their ability to develop positive social interactions in humans, pigs, and any species you want to look at.
Simon, Nat, Isaac, when you find, let's just say it's the aggressor or the tail biter or the bully sow in the pen of group sows, what do you do with those individuals?
Is there a sow timeout? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of the challenge is, you know, one, will that animal ever be conditioned to the point where it's not the aggressor or it's not the instigator? Or do you say, well, yep, our recommendation is to put all the bullies together and let them, how do you approach those?
You made a good comment. And if you remember at the beginning, I was telling, like, sometimes we look for the consequence. No, the consequence is the problem that we see, but we don't know the cause. And sometimes we don't know the transport between the cause and the consequence. And sometimes it's the pig that eats or bites, in that particular case, the scenario that you're putting. And what we try to do is to remove this animal and put this animal in another pen. That's what we try to do. The problem, as Nat said at the beginning, we are not that many hours inside the farm, or even the farm is not that many hours. And that links to, if you want a next level of discussion, of the ratio of people and number of animals that we take care of nowadays, it's completely different. But not going into that now, going to that point, if we don't spend that time and we don't find the biter, the only solution, the only thing that we can do is remove the bully, the one that has been bitten, and put him in another pen and try to treat this animal, cure the bone.
Yeah. So I'll comment, and I'm going to pretty much take a wean to finish stance from it, you know, from a commercial perspective. So I'm not exactly sure on the sow farm end, because obviously you want to get them, especially if they are bred, you want to get a litter out of them, et cetera. But, and a lot of this, what I'll say is somewhat anecdotal. So I'm cautiously going to say it in front of a bunch of expert researchers, but you know, oftentimes, yeah, if we can identify that biter, ideally we're going to remove it. If we have the space in another pen, a sick pen, a corner in the room that has feed and water access, you know, we could set it aside and hopefully still get it to market. But I will also say that it's not uncommon that biter or that active aggressive pig in there that's causing a lot of the biting is one of the smaller pigs. And it's interesting to watch and kind of just look at, because you wonder, are they limited on resources? You know, are they getting pushed out of the feeder? Are they not getting their daily allotted amount of water or nutrients, et cetera?
Yeah, as Nat said, I mean, it quite often is a smaller pig that's triggering tail biting. Quite often it's a female, because the females tend to be a little bit smaller. The reason comes back to that idea of a tipping cup or a tipping glass of water, that the animal that's smaller, that's not doing as well as its group mates, is that bit easier to push over. So that's the animal to look out for. So there was some work between the college where I work for, Scotland's Rural College, and Chagas in Ireland, where they looked at different strategies to deal with tail biting once it was spotted in a pen. And they tried three different strategies, which were to provide a rope in the pen, hanging into the pen, that the pigs could chew, or taking out the pig doing the biting, or taking out the one that was the victim. And they tried those in three steps, and they tried them in random order. They found that there was no single strategy that was better than any other. They did find that the rope seemed to act most quickly. It seemed to bring a tail biting episode to an end most quickly. But what they did find is that when they implemented that strategy of giving one implementation, and then if that didn't work, doing the next step, and if that didn't work, doing the third step in random order, then they found that that did actually manage to nip in the bud the majority of tail biting episodes. So these things can be brought under control, but you really have to get in there quick. And it's important to be looking for this starting, and as soon as it starts, to act quickly. So again, as Isaac's saying, it's down to having people in the buildings and spotting this thing happening early on.
Our thanks to special guest Dr. Simon Turner and PIC's Nat Stass, with Dr. Justin Hull and Dr. Isaac Huerta. Whether you're tuning in for the first time or you're a longtime listener, take a second to subscribe to The Squeal. It's the easiest way to stay up to date with the latest podcast episodes. Just search for The Squeal wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're already a subscriber, visit your phone settings and turn notifications on so you'll never miss an episode. For PIC, international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.